Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Jack Hartnell. He is head of research at the National Gallery, London, and honorary associate professor in the Department of Art History and World Art Studies at the University of East Anglia, Norwich. And we're talking about his new book, Wound Man, The Many Lives of a Surgical Image. Jack, welcome to the show. It is a real pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Fantastic to be here. Thanks. Thanks, Mark.
I have to admit, when your publicist said, would you want an interview about a book called Wound Man? I said, yeah, I'm in. It's like, and then I got your book. Then I read your book, and it's even weirder than I thought. First of all, let's describe the image of a classic wound man.
Sure. So it's an image that begins in the to be produced in manuscripts. So think of a kind of a page of a, what you might think of as a medieval manuscript. So it begins in manuscripts in the late 14th and into the 15th century. So I think the earliest one we have probably is from 1399, something like that. Mm-hmm. So imagine the kind of parchment page, it's got the slightly faded sort of feel of a parchment page. I don't know if anyone of your listeners has actually ever held a bit of parchment in their hands, but it's very stiff often, almost more like a piece of plastic, and often is a sort of, you get the surface of the original animal. Sometimes it feels sort of slightly hairy to the touch. So it's got some texture, and atop it, in the early manuscript versions of this rather wild image, you would see an image of a man. He's standing facing you with his arms normally out to his sides, his legs kind of wide-legged stance. Often, for reasons that I go into a little bit in later chapters, he's wearing a pair of blue Speedos, but nothing else. You don't really notice that he's naked because his entire body is covered, kind of beset, really from the top of his head down to the tip of his feet, with objects, accoutrements, signs of illness, accident, weapons poking into his body. It's basically, his body is covered in wounds, hence the term wound man, which is, Wundenmann was the German term that a scholar in the 19-teens, one of the first scholars to ever look at this image, kind of dubbed him, and that way he has been ever since. So a very striking, aggressive, often beautifully colored image, but one which appears in loads of different crises, as I sort of discovered as I went into the deep dive in the book, for best part of 400 or 500 years thereafter, in lots of different forms.
How did you first come across this image?
I'm a medievalist by training, so I'm used to kind of trawling through the pages of medieval manuscripts, and I'm an art historian as well, so I'm really often been interested in the visual and material culture of European medieval art generally, and especially manuscripts. Interestingly, it's an image that I think I probably first came across, not in a publication exploring its art historical value, but it's often used, and I sort of start the book by talking about this, in a slightly spectacular way. I talk at the beginning about how this image has had quite an empty, spectacular life, if that makes sense. So people often just plonk it up because they want a jazzy, dust jacket for a book on the general history of the Middle Ages. It appears all over the internet. Like this, I first started looking at it probably before it was used widespread as a meme. But one of the things, if you Google a kind of wound man and tattoo, a lot of people have had tattoos of this very striking image. So it appears all over different kinds of popular culture. I came across it first because there's an amazing manuscript example of it in a collection in London where I live and work, at the Wellcome Collection, which is an amazing collection of medieval manuscripts that was housed, was kind of produced over the course of the 20th century by a pharmaceutical industrialist, Henry Wellcome. And I sort of was actually took students to see some of their manuscript materials, and we kind of often would pore over this one example, and that got me thinking, where did this thing come from, and what's its history?
It's a startling image. I mean, and depending on what your day's been like, it's also really wildly humorous. It's like something out of Monty Python. You're right. And this is an image, and this is using your own term, of pre-modern medicine.
Right.
But it's not. It's an image that you also describe as both troubling and enigmatic. And you really have to read your book to understand the depth of both of those terms. It is a It is a wild image to see this guy just sort of beset with every possible thing that could be wrong sticking out of his body or on the surface of his skin. And you also write that it resists clear interpretation. It's not simply just an illustration to be used in a medical text, although it is that. It is a lot of other things, too.
This is one of the things that's really interesting. So that sort of empty spectacular life is because people just often take it as an image of nothing but violence, right? He's a guy, as I said, he's naked, he's got a club smashed into his head, he's got a spear in his side, and you just think, oh, it's just generic and violent. And historians who have thought a lot about the image of and images of extreme violence especially talk a lot about how, I think this is really interesting in our own contemporary day as well, how an image of violence and images of violence can often really become quite anonymous quite quickly. They become interesting for us or striking to us because of their depiction of the act of violence. And we often forget about the person to whom the violence is being perpetrated. And I think this is absolutely the case for this historical image. People just think of it as spectacular. But even some close looking just at the image itself suggests something slightly more is afoot. So he's got these weapons, but also he's like treading on a nail, suggests that maybe a person who's befallen a more quotidian, you know, everyday accident. He's also got other bits of like rashes. If you look at his armpits and his groin, he often is sporting these rounded blue, sometimes red buboes, suggesting that he's contracted certain kinds of diseases, maybe plague. So actually, we can read his body already from lots of different kinds of injuries. And actually, the kind of key thing is that many of these images are surrounded by little catchwords of text that describe, or sometimes the little numbers that link to paragraphs on the pages after this image, or sometimes before this image, which actually are all about how a medieval surgeon, a very particular kind of healer in Europe in the 15th century, how he or mostly he, but sometimes she, but mostly he, would go about curing these things. So all of a sudden, an image that we thought was all about just like spectacular misery and like memeified, you know, you thought you were having a bad Monday kind of feeling, right, very quickly becomes, actually, this is a almost like an image in a medical textbook. And that's kind of what many of the different books in which it's found were trying to do. They were often pulling to their different kind of catalogues of medical practice. And the image was the thing that kind of anchored them like a table of contents. And so suddenly it becomes not an image about abstract violence, but an image about cure. And we realize when we think about that, his eyes are always open, right?
Yeah.
No matter the horrible things of this fibrous beset, he's very much alive in this suspended, strange space of a medieval manuscript page. And so I actually think, weirdly, what ends up, if you just even start to think about it on those terms, it does a bit of a flip. If the worst case scenario suddenly becomes a quite hopeful image,
right,
that maybe if you find the right healer, you can endure some of these injuries, although maybe not all of them at once.
There's an interesting discussion you have in early on in the book about diagrams. And are wound men just diagrams? And what is a diagram?
Yeah. Well, diagram is really interesting as a term. It's not a term in the way that we think of it used today that would have actually been familiar to someone who was practicing medicine or looking at images in the 15th century. It's a term that emerges much later in the 18th century in the European Enlightenment, and it kind of takes that kind of, if you were to break down the Greek of it, think about the term as a dia, through, and sort of, so it's kind of through knowing. It's an image that is a sort of vehicle for an idea. But diagrams, they're quite tricksy things, a bit like the wound man's, that positive, negative sense of both aspects of it. A diagram, it's sort of caught between two poles, and this, as you say, is what the first chapter of the book is about, thinking about European medical and other kinds of diagrams. On the one hand, the images of the kind from which the wound man springs are all very technical images, right? We think of a diagram as being really technical, and it tells you how something is done. It demonstrates and is closely related to either a mathematical proof or a conceptual argument. They're images that argue in some way, but alongside a text. But on the other hand, you know, maybe think of the word illustration, something that simply illuminates, that enlivens, that makes more beautiful a kind of a manuscript page. You know, we've all looked at, that's why kids learn and enjoy picture books rather than books with just text in. They do something and transform the experience of reading. So we've got these two poles, one that's all about conveying knowledge and argumentation, and the other that is all about beautifying and making aesthetic and therefore kind of interesting a text. And what's really interesting about diagrams is they're kind of often doing both, and the Woo Man definitely is often doing both. If you think about the different kinds of potential users of a manuscript like this, let's imagine that one of the kinds of users might be someone who's a practicing medieval surgeon. He's obviously not taking out this extremely expensive manuscript produced beautifully by a high quality artist as he's like trying to cure someone who's got a spear lodged into the side of their neck, right?
I mean he's not got the book in hand while in the other.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And of course, think about how much information a modern doctor has had to absorb over the course of their training in order to practice.
Right.
There's no reason, something I always have to remind my students of, people of the past were not, you know, stupider than we were. In fact, if anything, without all the technological prompts that we have, they probably had more things going on in their memory. They've committed to memory many more aspects of their trade than modern doctors may have well done today, because it's much harder maybe for them to look it up. So all this information is known to this person. So the question then is, why do they have this beautiful illustrated diagram?
And this is we have to emphasize, remember, this is pre-print we're talking about for the beginning part of the book. So these are expensive volumes that were very detailed too. I just want to digress. The plates in this book, I spent hours just looking at them with a magnifying glass.
It's a very beautifully illustrated book. Yeah, and the people at Princeton University Press who published it have done an amazing job of kind of trying to capture something of the really kind of strange but very beautiful.
Getting back to your point though, so if this sort of early pre-medical surgeon is not holding the book in his hand while he's got the patient in front of him, how are they being used?
Yeah, great question. So I kind of think of them a little bit like they're kind of doing maybe the same kind of work as a fancy doctor's offices might be doing. If you went to go and see a doctor today and, they're in a very expensive office with you decked out beautifully, you're getting all sorts of kind of signals as to what kind of individual this is that you're going to see. For one thing, an expensive object, just like an expensive surgical saw, for instance, or an expensive tool, right, is important for a medieval medic because for any patient that encounters them, it shows that they've been paid. And if you've been paid, your patient has survived. Okay? And you, in a sense, are making money from your craft. You're highly qualified. You're capable. So it almost functions a bit like a white coat. It's credentialing. Huh. Or maybe a bit more medics of all different kinds display maybe a sort of doctoral diploma or something on the walls behind them, right? It shows that they have the capacity to read and engage with this material, that they maybe have ownership over the contents of this often big, spectacularly illustrated book. Also that they have the means to have one produced. Also, maybe if you're on the fence about engaging with a particular surgeon for one reason or whatever, and I should say, most surgeons in this period that we're talking about, they're not dealing with interior emergency medicine in the way that we think of them doing today.
No.
We're dealing with a world which was very happy with medicine, or had to be happy with medicine, just simply being less effective. And that was sort of built in alongside other kinds of medical and spiritual kind of practices of healing. But probably one of the things you would have gone to surgeons for maybe is to heal a scar or to stitch a wound, a lot of stuff on the surface of the body. So you might be saying, do I want to go to this guy? Does he know his business? He takes and reaches down from his bookshelf and flicks open this expensive, jazzy, arresting image. And all of a sudden you see this person who's so much worse off than you are. And you think, gosh, okay, well, if he can cure him, then he can cure me. And maybe there's something of the doctor-patient encounter there that's being captured. And it's quite hard to put your finger on whether that's exactly what's going on. But I think we probably think that's probably part of what this image is doing.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Jack Hartnell. He's head of research at the National Gallery London, honorary associate professor in the Department of Art History and World Art, World Art Studies at the University of East Anglia, Norwich. And we're talking about his new book. It is fascinating. Wound Man, The Many Lives of a Surgical Image. One of the sections of the book I really enjoyed were the sort of precedents for Wound Man, the earlier images that had both texts and illustration. One of them, The Axis of Brotherly Perversion of 1435 in Austria. And it, what a weird, I mean, that's the other thing about your book. You've got not just Wound Man, you've got a lot of other really unusual and fascinating images.
Yeah, it's really interesting to think about the different, like you said, diagrammatic precedents for this. So there are lots of images within the history of medicine that we could turn to. I spend a large chunk of the book talking about bloodletting figures.
Oh, yeah. And
letting blood.
Those are fascinating exactly, so looking. Yeah.
Strategic extraction of blood from the body to balance the humors, a central part of medieval theory, kind of medical theory. So they're often plotted. You get images of, they're normally men, occasionally women, but pretty much always men, with these big snaking red lines that go from a particular spot on the body out to a little bit of text that explains why you might want to evacuate blood from that point in the body. So you get these like webs of text around individuals, or you get others which are these circular wheels, which are all about the different colors of a patient's urine, which is very important, again, in medical healing. So plotting information. But my suggestion, and of many of my colleagues who are working in this field as well, is that we need to look beyond just medicine. So the image that you talk about, the fantastically named Axis of Brotherly Perversion, comes from a text, the Book of Wheels of True and False Religion by a French author named Hugh de Fouilly. And essentially what he has is it's a sort of book which is all about good monastic living, how to be a good monk, or how to be a bad monk. And as you guessed it, the Axis of Brotherly Perversion is a sort of big circle, which actually has lots of different terms written around the outside, but shows all of the different possible problems that someone might befall or temptations that they might befall if they want to try and be a good. So at the top, you see a quote, good abbot. He's sitting on the top on a throne, kind of enthroned over this circular diagram, and he's sort of, you know, dispensing his important kind of religious and monastic authority in the proper way. But slowly, as you turn around the diagram, you have different versions of this figure, like holding on to this circular wheel. He's being pulled down by a demon. At the bottom, he's there looking impoverished with this like gambling knife thrown to the side. And so it's sort of, it goes back to what we were saying before about what a diagram's doing. On the one hand, it's kind of enlivening and making exciting this visual argument that Hugh is engaging with in his work. But it's also a way of remembering it, right? We need to think about diagrams as being really important mnemonic devices in this period. And so maybe it's a way of remembering, seeing visualized on the page, all of the different potential temptations and sins to which one might succumb in this particular line of work, plotted out so that you can kind of call them to mind. And as a result, call to mind everything that Hugh says in the rest of the book. So they're kind of their memory devices as well.
Some of these images are so so heavy on written text. They're amazing. The whole area surrounding the body is filled, these early images are filled with text. And it's also amazing the variety and skill of rendering the human body that you find in these illustrations. I mean, it's amazing. Yeah. Some of them are just gorgeous, really detailed, and a lot of crosshatching and all sorts of other detail. They really are fascinating. So are we assuming that every new image was just a copy of an earlier image? The doctor himself is not making this image.
Well, I mean, there are some, it's worth saying, where we think they probably were because they are terrible. I mean, and this is where me as an art historian, you know, I've said this before, but art historians, I think, sometimes maybe a bit highfalutin in their kind of way of thinking. And they often, you know, we learn as much from an image that is really bad as we do from an image that is absolutely exquisitely beautiful. So there's an example of one which I've, you know, speak about a lot in the book, which is a wound man from a manuscript that's now in a library in the town of Solothurn in Switzerland, which is clearly just someone who's seen one maybe in another manuscript and is jotting it down. It's just kind of quickly scrapping and jotting it down, and then the text follows on the pages afterwards. So it's someone prompting their own memory. It's someone who's really thinking about, you know, how they, maybe it's a student perhaps in the process of absorbing an image almost in the style of a textbook. And we have to think about manuscripts as being generally in this period part of this really like, fascinating and very intricate network of information exchange. So we know, you know, right from the very kind of most elite scholars all the way down to individuals who are much kind of, you know, maybe more concerned with practical methods of not just treatment, but just discourse in the broadest sense, that books are being traded, copied, recopied, passed backwards and forwards. So there's definitely, and I think what literary historians have reminded us is that we shouldn't really think of texts, think of everything, like, you know, think of, for instance, the Canterbury Tales, think, you know, you can go into the age of print and think about, you know, Shakespeare's works, right? These big canonical texts, which we think of as being this single static object, actually, you know, these, it's better, I think, especially in this earlier period, to think about texts and images as almost being this kind of constantly reformulated set of values. So it might be that in copying something, a text or indeed an image, someone might want to make a change because of a particular audience that they're kind of making the image for, or because they want, if they're making it for themselves, to remind themselves of a particular detail, or they might want to correct something, to update it based on new medical information. So they're constantly shifting and changing. And I think with the images, it's the same thing. So it might be that individual artists or individual, you know, people making slightly less sophisticated versions of this image are copying to some degree, maybe the array of objects. But let's take the example of a butcher's knife, which slices often into the arm of one of the figures. Say the design of a butcher's knife has changed between when the image, you know, over 50 years. I don't know enough about the history of butchery to tell you if that's true, but let's just say it was. Then you might want to update how that knife looks. So the location of it and the medicine which is required to treat a butcher's knife injury is the same, but the image might shift and change and be updated. Now imagine that amplified for the sort of 40-odd different images, different injuries rather, that are around this figure. And you can imagine that these are images that really shimmer and change as they move from one to the other.
We only have a few minutes. Manuscript form. We have only a few minutes left, and there's so much I wanted to talk to you about. But there are images of diseased women. And those images are wild when you compare them to Wound Man. There's also a Diseased Man series of images.
Yes.
But the female images
that emerge around the same time. Yeah.
Diseased women, it's amazing. The kind of detail that's put on the body is never, it doesn't seem to be as good as the detail that was put on the male illustrations. All the women are very pear-shaped.
Well, that's partly because so these three images, the Wound Man, the Diseased Man, and the Diseased Woman, all emerge around the same time in relation to the same sort of series of texts. So the Wound Man is related to a surgical text that's often accompanied by a Diseased Man, who's related to a kind of a text that's more about humoral medicine, so all the different diseases the body might succumb to, plotted just in name rather than visualized in a more kind of literal sense on a body. And then there's this image of the Diseased Woman, which is accompanied by images around, texts rather, around often related to gynecology and obstetrics. And what's really interesting about her is her treatment visually on the page is very, for want of a better word, anatomical.
Yep.
There's a real interest in the inside of her body. So the front of her stomach and chest are kind of almost disappeared, and we see almost like we're looking x-ray beneath her. So we see the tubes of her intestines and her esophagus, which are all labeled, her heart and her lungs and her kidneys, often a little fetus inside a little womb. And I think what's playing out there is really, so some work that historians of medicine for many years have been doing to carefully think about different kinds of gendered bodies in the medieval period in Europe, especially. So to kind of simplify, often the male body is seen in terms of humoral medicine of the time as a kind of normative body. So it might be that, you know, the Wound Man plots obviously injuries that both men and women could succumb to. So it's a male body, but it's all bodies who have been collapsed into it. Whereas the female body, the thing that really often excites the largely male academic and practical medical elite, is its remarkable capacity to produce life inside it. Many of the texts that are accompanying this image of the Diseased Man are focused around, given the sort of catch-all title, Secreta Mulierum, the secrets of women. And that's not to say that women are privy to certain kinds of secrets in their mind that men aren't, but rather the female body is almost a secret which needs to be explored and opened. So maybe in this anatomical imagery, what we're seeing is like really revealing to a largely male academic and kind of surgical audience the inner workings of these kind of female secrets. So she ends up looking quite pear-shaped, as you say, because there's so much going on inside her body that the illustrator has to try and fit in.
Did these images of Wound Man go into the time period of print so that they were actually mechanically printed?
Do they? Absolutely, yeah. Yes. So in 1491, we actually know of probably one of the very first to be printed by a pair of printers working in Venice. And very quickly, the image takes on quite a different set of lives.
We're going to have to wind it up there, unfortunately, because we're completely out of time.
Not to worry.
I know. My guest tonight is Jack Hartnell. He's the head of research at the National Gallery of London and honorary associate professor in the Department of Art History and World Art Studies at the University of East Anglia, Norwich. And we've been talking about his new book. There is so much more we could be talking about. Wound Man, The Many Lives of a Surgical Image. Jack, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.